Welcome to the podcast of the Diane Rehm Show Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists joins Diane to discuss the week's top stories from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Today, Israel is blockaded Lebanon, where Hezbollah militants continue to launch rockets into Israel. Tomorrow, the Arab League holds an emergency summit amid escalating tensions throughout the Middle East. President Bush joins fellow world leaders in Russia for this weekend's G8 summit. And here in Washington, Valerie Plame Joseph Wilson files suit against Vice President Cheney, Karl Rove, and other administrations. With me this morning to talk about all these stories and more, William Kristol of the Weekly Standard, USA Today's Susan Page, and Clarence Page, no relation, of the Chicago Tribune. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
It is a week filled with sad, sad news, I must say. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. How is the international community, Susan, responding to this entire Middle East uprising?
Yeah, we see the Middle East looking like it's moving toward a regional war, the likes of which we haven't seen in a quarter century or more. And the United States, President Bush came out yesterday, asserted Israel's right to defend itself, but also said he hopes this doesn't lead to a destabilization of the Lebanese government, which the United States had taken some pride.
And Condoleezza Rice urging restraint, even as the president defends Israel's rights.
And among European leaders, including those that President Bush will be meeting with this weekend in St. Petersburg in the G8 summit, concern about what some of them called a disproportionate response by Israel, concern that Israel, in its effort to respond to security threats, unquestionably they face that, has gone too far and really sparked what could be a fire that goes out of control.
And Bill Kristol, of course, Israel is blaming Syria and Iran. Are they responsible?
Sure. Hezbollah would certainly not exist without Iran, and it was Hezbollah that went across an internationally recognized border, a border that had been reestablished when Israel withdrew from Lebanon about 6 years ago, and killed and kidnapped Israeli soldiers. And, of course, Hamas's military leader is in Syria and protected by the government of Syria. And Israel seems to be taking seriously President Bush's doctrine that states that harbor and sponsor terrorism have to be held responsible for terrorist groups.
Clarence Page, there's a UN delegation heading to the area to try to bring about some conversation on this issue.
Indeed, there is, and we can only hope that they can try to serve as honest brokers in bringing some parties together. The trouble is, as you know, what's really frustrating about the situation is that neither the countries over in that region or the U.S. Have gotten any better at dealing with terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah. Hamas kidnaps an Israeli soldier, Hezbollah kidnaps two Israeli soldiers. This is largely a power struggle within groups in that region, and it has the effect so far of destabilizing established governments or threatening established governments like that of Lebanon, and causing a threat of war between countries. Meanwhile, the terrorist groups themselves are sort of riding high right now, using this leverage, and that's a very, very frustrating situation.
But how do you measure a disproportionate response versus an appropriate response, Susan?
Well, it probably depends on where you sit. You know, I think the Israelis would argue it's not a disproportionate response, and I think the Lebanese, the officials in the Palestinian territories, would argue that it is one. And, of course, another complication is the U.S. role. The U.S. traditionally has played a big role when peace has come about or peace agreements have come about in the Middle East. The U.S. has been, to some degree, disengaged from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because of the attention that we've been forced to pay to the war in Iraq. I don't think Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, has been in Israel since late last year. I think it was November was her last trip. And so it's not clear what position the U.S. is in to try to bring about some to tamp down what seems to be happening there.
What can the U.S. do at this point, Bill Kristol?
Not much, probably. I mean, Israel is not going to permit Hezbollah to, they're not going to permit, as they've said, the status quo ante. They're not going to permit a terrorist group to control neighboring territory with thousands of missiles and with an expressed desire to kill and kidnap Israelis and to ultimately destroy the state of Israel. And so the U.S. could put pressure on Syria and Iran. That's the main thing the U.S. could do. Presumably we're doing that to some degree, but I would
through
argue
the U.N.
Well, through bilaterally, we have a lot of leverage on countries like Syria and Iran, especially Syria, I think, which is a weak country. And I would argue, actually, that one reason that Hamas and Hezbollah have been emboldened has been relative weakness over the last 6-9 months by the U.S. vis-a-vis Syria and Iran. Someone was quoted in the paper this week saying Iran feels that they're winning. They're riding high. You have this guy, you know, going through the Middle East, defying the entire world community, restarting his nuclear program, explicitly supporting terrorist groups that want to destroy the state of Israel. This isn't about occupied territories. This is about destroying the state of Israel, and he's paid no price at all.
Because the U.S. is overextended in Iraq, Clarence Page.
Well, that's part of the reason, you could say, but at the same time, Iran has been in a remarkably strong position here since they Hezbollah is like a wholly owned subsidiary, virtually, of Iran, and Hamas as well gets this critical support. And it's a situation in which, as I mentioned earlier, you've got government factions in Lebanon, in Syria, and other regional factions fighting among themselves, while Iran is pretty much sitting high.
And you see the administration, the Bush administration, having to face crises everywhere they look, from Somalia to Afghanistan to Israel. And, you know, in a way, President Bush offered a sort of grand bargain with the invasion of Iraq, that establishing a stable democracy in Iraq would ripple through the region, would in fact make Israel safer, not more imperiled. And you see that seeming to crumble away in the places where there were optimistic things. Iraq, the violence continues there. Lebanon, imperiled. Afghanistan, trouble there. The Palestinian territories, where there finally were elections that had seemed so encouraging. I think this goes to the fundamental argument, or one of the fundamental arguments that the administration made with the decision to invade Iraq.
Susan Page of USA Today, Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, and William Kristol of the Weekly Standard. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And we do look forward to hearing your emails as well. Send those to drshow@wamu.org. How is the crisis that's going on now between Israel and Lebanon, Hezbollah, Hamas, going to affect President Bush's G8 participation? Bill Kristol.
Well, they'll go ahead with the meetings and the photo ops, but there is something. One doesn't think that the central issues of the world, you know, are going to be resolved at this G8. In the 90s, these G8 meetings were pretty important. You know, the main issues seemed to be economics and removing trade barriers, development issues, even dealing with things like Kosovo and the Balkans, which there was a sort of U.S.-European agreement on. But I don't believe much is going to be accomplished at the G8 in dealing with Iran or Syria. Or the real issues that confront us today.
Still, I'd be curious. You've got maybe a better perspective on this, Bill, because you've worked in a White House. But it seems to me there probably is some value just having all these leaders in one place at a time of crisis, so they're forced to talk to one another, whether they like to or not.
And they've got to talk about this issue.
It's hard to imagine that they will talk that other things that this crisis won't overwhelm what they had planned to talk about.
Right, but I mean, it's most of the leaders have very little leverage on most of these countries. I mean, China and Russia, Italy, Britain, Germany, France. I mean, are they going to what are they going to do about Iran or about Syria, or to reassure Israel that is the world community going to prevent Hezbollah from resetting up its sort of mini terror state in South Lebanon? The UN agreed that Hezbollah had to be disarmed. That was the condition of the Israeli withdrawal and the recognition of the international border. It was the condition of the new Lebanese government when the Syrians were kicked out about a year and a half ago. They haven't been disarmed. I haven't noticed a lot of these European countries or Russia spending a lot of time worrying about that. We probably haven't spent as much time worrying about it as we should. And when you have that situation, then you're going to get the cross-border attack by Hezbollah, and you're going to get a response by Israel.
That's especially frustrating because Hezbollah has got so many enemies these days. I mean, they've made so many enemies within Lebanon and elsewhere. Iran is just about their only friend, and yet you still don't see the world community coming together to isolate them.
I must say I was fascinated with the reported exchange or statement on the part of President Putin when he welcomed George Bush into his dacha, and the Labrador that Putin owns jumped up on President Bush, and Putin turned to Bush and said, "Bigger, tougher, stronger, faster, meaner than Barney," President Bush's own dog. President Bush's aide sort of blew this off and said it was a mark of friendship. Russian policy analyst said they heard a different message. The testing also conveys a sense of self-confidence married to self-doubt that dates to Zara's times. I thought that was fascinating.
That is amazing. And, of course, we have some tough issues with Russia, including Putin's crackdown on democracy there. But I think the United States is not in a position to push those because we need Russia with us when we go to the UN Security Council on issues like Iran and North Korea.
Of course, they're not with us. I mean, I think the failure to put pressure on Putin gives him more running room, as your little story about the dog suggests. He doesn't seem like he's on the defensive.
Hardly. Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard, Susan Page of USA Today, and Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup. We spent the first part of this program talking about what's happened in Israel, in Lebanon, between and among the Palestinians, Hamas, Hezbollah, the bombing of the airport, the killing of, I think now the number is up to about 55 individuals in Lebanon, many of them ordinary citizen. Turning now to India, you had Tuesday bombs exploding on a crowded commuter train, 8 explosions, 7 on train cars, 1 in the station. Bombs were set in first-class men's cars targeting wealthy businessmen. The latest count there, 200 dead, 700 plus injured. What do we know about who was behind those attacks, Clarence?
Well, there's immediate speculation that this is tied in with the Kashmir rebels and that ongoing dispute, decades old, and also some reports on the wire about possible al-Qaeda connections. So it's pretty preliminary. They're bringing in well over 100 people, maybe perhaps hundreds, for questioning. I'm sure we're going to hear more information in coming hours and days. But
actually mean for India-Pakistan relations?
Not good.
Not it's, good.
In fact, eyes are on Pakistan. Last time I checked, it's Indian eyes on Pakistan, which is just natural. And, of course, those are two countries that are in dispute over Kashmir.
Does anybody get the impression that somehow what's happening in the world now is that violence has been unleashed? And if so, why? Bill Kristol.
Well, look, no, I think that's right. And I wonder what one wonders what connections there are between the Indian bombing and the London bombing was exactly a year earlier. And they seem to like doing things on the 11th of months for whatever reason. I mean, India, Britain, Spain, especially under the previous government, the U.S., are all viewed as opponents of radical Islam's march towards power. India obviously stands in the way of Pakistan and occupies, or they think it occupies Kashmir. India thinks it, you know, control it. It's simply defending an international border there. But India's, I think this is, you know, there is a terror network that is inspired by a very, fanatical version of Islam that attacks the enemies of what they regard as their enemies and is willing to kill civilians. And we've made some progress in dismantling, I think, parts of that network, no question, in the last 4 or 5 years. But not enough.
And, of course, whether or not they're formally connected, there have been lessons on how easy it is to attack transportation networks, how terrifying that is. I guess I would disagree, though, with one thing that Clarence just said, that both the leaders of India and Pakistan took pains not to kind of take the bait after this, to say that it shouldn't upend efforts to find some kind of resolution to Kashmir, although we haven't seen much progress here. Mm-hmm. And you also saw the city going right back to work. You know, this is really the financial center of India. And I thought that perhaps that indicates leaders kind of learning better how to handle these terrifying situations and maybe citizens as well.
This does tell me that perhaps, you know, Pakistan's government didn't have anything to do with it. You know, they're distancing themselves from it. But it still doesn't mean al-Qaeda, which you know, Pakistan's hills are filled with al-Qaeda.
Meanwhile, in Iraq, you've got violence escalating. You've got Secretary Rumsfeld visiting the city of Baghdad this week. What plans do the military have to try to stop this bloodshed? General Casey said this week, you may have to up the number of troops.
Yeah, of course, that'd be very distressing to a lot of Americans who'd like to see U.S. troops beginning to come home. And that's been a goal that Secretary Rumsfeld has talked about as well. But I do think that if you look at the violence, particularly in Baghdad, it seems to be getting worse, not better, despite the creation of this coalition government, the completion of it, and the declaration by that government that they were going to put an end or, you know, reduce the level of violence that citizens in Baghdad are now living with.
Ambassador Kali's daughter, ambassador to Iraq, had a little briefing for some background for some columnists and all yesterday. And he was, without breaking the rules of the briefing, I would say he was quite candid. The good news is they're not painting, you know, there's no more happy talk, at least from him. He said publicly, I think, things are getting worse in some respects in the security situation. They're putting a huge amount of hope in the unity government and in Maliki, who seems like an impressive guy. And they do have a genuine unity government with Sunnis and Kurds and Shia. And they're hoping that that can defuse the insurgency and, what is worse than an insurgency almost, the sectarian violence that the terrorists have sparked. I mean, in this respect, Zarqawi unfortunately may have succeeded in lighting matches to timber that is now burning beyond the control of any terrorist group. You can kill a lot of terrorists, but once the sectarian violence gets out of hand, it's very worrisome. I don't think the security situation is in hand, frankly, and I do think, you know, we should have sent more troops much, much longer ago, because if you cannot get security, it's very hard to make political and economic progress.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And you hear talk again about the possibility of a kind of federation of states in Iraq to try to address these sectarian divisions. That's something the United States does not want to have happen, but it's an idea that Joe Biden, the Democratic senator from Delaware, the senior Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, has talked about, and some other analysts have also talked about whether that is the path that we will end up at in Iraq.
You know, you've got Iraq, Afghanistan, now Israel, now Lebanon. It is spreading, it seems to me, and I once again do wonder about violence unleashed, as though there is some permission granted internally to people who want to wreak havoc in order to gain their positions. Here's an email from Barbara from San Antonio, who says, I'm very frustrated. Our government will not negotiate directly with various parties. And of course, that includes North Korea as well. Do your guests think the administration might change this policy? And I would add, in light of the havoc that's going on. Clarence.
Well, I think the administration is taking these cases on a case-by-case basis, and it's possible. But there are good things to be said for trying to have a multilateral solution to problems. It's not necessarily a bad thing. With North Korea, I have questions about how much of the policy was guided by President Bush's desire simply not to duplicate President Clinton and to have a different policy, because I think in that instance there might be an advantage to direct negotiations. At the same time, it's not a bad idea to try to pull in China and other countries in the region. President Bush is trying to do that with Iran now, and trying to, after being accused of being, of being a monolateral in his approach to Iraq, he is trying to pull in more countries.
And I just want to follow up on your thought, Diane, about the violence that seems to have been unleashed here in the first part of the 21st century. I mean, one does have the sense that it's different from, you know, there have always been national disputes, there have always been border disputes, there have always been conflicting interests. They've led to wars, sometimes very brutal wars. But you do now have a radical ideology that explicitly embraces violence and killing, and for that matter, suicide bombing and terror. And it is, unfortunately, has gained some ground in the world. It has some state sponsors, or at least states who tolerate it and support groups that advocate this vehemently on television and on the internet, and recruit young men to engage in these violent acts. And that is very dangerous. I really agree with you. It's more like, in a way, like Nazism in the 30s or communism, an ideology that... It's one thing to have states that reluctantly go to war because they feel that they're in a box, or that they have to resolve a practical dispute. It's another thing to have a worldwide ideology that explicitly embraces the use of terror, and that's a very scary thing.
Let's talk about the offshoot of what's happened in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and that is the holding of prisoners at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib. Members of Congress say they got mixed messages from the administration this week about how to go about authorizing a legal process for trying suspected terrorists detained by the U.S. at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. What exactly did members of Congress hear, Susan?
Well, first, you heard the Defense Department, the number two man in the Defense Department, come out write a memo and speak out on Tuesday, really seeming to welcome the Supreme Court decision that is forcing the administration to followed the part of the Geneva Conventions in their handling of these detainees.
That they were entitled to that.
Then you had Justice Department officials who did not seem to be on board with that policy. And I had, I had lunch on background yesterday with a Republican senator who said the administration clearly wants them to do something, but they aren't sure what the administration wants Congress to do. And Congress has some strong views, too. Congress is not of one mind in this. House Republicans are much more likely to give the administration its head, you know, to approve what it is, so the administration can proceed much as they have. Republicans in the Senate, as well as Democrats, are much more likely to devise a system that imposes many more restrictions on how the administration can proceed.
And, of course, you had the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee speaking out with concerns about White House secrecy. He said, Congressman Pete Hoekstra, Republican of Michigan, said the White House may have broken the law by not briefing intelligence committees on secret programs, Clarence.
Yeah, what's significant here is not just what was said, but who said it. I guess Congressman Hoekstra has been a defender and a strong supporter of President Bush's policy, especially insofar as intelligence, and been critical of the way the media have handled disclosures about the National Security Agency, this sort of thing. And he himself was careful not to tell us exactly what it was that the administration had not told him and other members of Congress. So this carried a lot of weight in so far as the argument that the Bush administration has been leaving Congress in the dark, even their own allies.
But this is what I don't understand about these prisoners who especially are held at Guantanamo. According to the way this thing has been set up, they can have a trial, but they cannot know what is being charged. They cannot know who their accusers are. They cannot know whatever evidence is against them. How does this work in a democratic society?
Well, it's confusing, and that's why...
Confusing is a mild
No, really, and that's why, in a way, most people didn't think the Geneva Conventions applied to some subgroup of, you know, non-official, non-normal, so to speak, combatants. We don't have trials for POWs. We just hold them until the end of the war. The whole idea of trials for terrorists captured in Afghanistan, how would you have evidence? Who would testify? Who would remember 4 years before what this individual was doing when they rounded him up? It's almost like, I agree, it's very... The administration, I think, is... I think they've acted in good faith in the sense that I think they had a very difficult situation. They were confused, as everyone was. The Justice Department, the Defense Department, as Susan says, have probably been at different views of how to handle this. They haven't done a good job. They probably should have resolved in their own mind how they wanted to handle this and explained it better rather than let it drag out in this way. I mean, for all the talk about military tribunals, which the Supreme Court finally said were not permissible, I guess, in Hamdan, they never had any, right? It took them 4 years even to get them going.
Right.
Susan. But, you know, after 5 years after the 9/11 attacks, you finally see Congress pushing back against extraordinary assertions of administration authority. You see senators like Arlen Specter and members of the House like Peter Hoekstra now insisting on the kind of briefings that were, in fact, pretty routine before 9/11. And you see the courts pushing back, too. Now, the second, that's Hamdan court case, really the second in which the Supreme Court is asserting its role when the administration had denied that the federal court system had a role.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about Ambassador Joseph Wilson and his wife, Valerie Plame. They filed suit yesterday against Vice President Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, and Scooter Libby. They are holding a press conference today. Tell us about the suit, what it alleges, and what they're after, Susan.
Well, we assume I don't think they specified a dollar amount that they were about. I mean, I think it's about righting what they see as a wrong done against them. They charged that there was a White House conspiracy to expose Valerie Plame's role as a CIA agent, to make it harder for her and her husband to get employment. They charged that it's endangered their lives and the lives of their children. And they've filed the suit, even though there are big questions about whether it can go forward. You know, public officials generally are protected from legal action, civil legal action against their actions as officials. If the court does let it go forward, however, you could have a situation where Vice President Cheney, among others, is forced to give a deposition during discovery. You know, that's the very thing that got President Clinton in so much trouble in the Monica Lewinsky affair.
What kinds of hurdles does this case raise?
Well, there is a special prosecutor who's indicted one person for perjury. He seems to have indicted no one for any underlying crime here. There's no civil. I mean, I think that's going to block basically any civil action. I guess Wilson would have to prove damages to himself, which strikes me he's had a pretty prosperous last two or three years, so I don't think he'll be able to prove that. She will allege that her career was ended, but she'll have to then prove. I mean, what's odd about this is we know how her name came out. Her name came out in a column by Robert Novak, and he's been speaking for this week. Robert Novak has now revealed two of his three sources.
Two of his three.
Neither of which was Cheney or Libby. Rove was a confirming source, and it's going to turn out that his first source was not Cheney or Libby. It's going to be a rather non-political State Department, I believe, official. So I don't really see the point of this.
Bill Crystal, name that source.
Well, it's been printed that Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, was the likely source for Novak. But let me just say this. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Novak has said it wasn't a partisan gunslinger. It came up in the middle of a conversation about other things. I believe it probably came up in the sense of someone saying, "Ugh, don't the CIA. You know, this, they only sent Wilson on this trip because his wife proposed to him, et cetera." It was in casual conversation. Now, Novak printed it because he thought this was a little bit in the sixth paragraph. He didn't lead with it of his column because he thought it was a little bit of an interesting nugget. The idea that there was that there's grounds for a civil suit against a White House conspiracy.
If her life and those of the and the lives of their children are affected, don't they have grounds for a case?
Well, I think they've got legal grounds. The question in my mind is, why are they adopting this strategy rather than letting the whole thing go away?
Well,
and
I'll tell you what you're going to find out on Monday morning Joe Wilson is going to come on this program Monday morning.
Good. Well, I've talked to Joe Wilson on several occasions and all, and I think he and his wife, for one thing, are hopping angry. I don't blame them. I mean, they're personally angry at the way they've been treated and at the way a dual history is shaping itself in the internet and every place else. Largely politically tainted. Well, on the one side, you've got Wilson doing his job. On the other side, you've got this boondoggle he was on, sent off because his wife had connections and blah, blah, blah. From start to finish, so one side is calling him a hero, one side is calling him a liar and this sort of thing. I think that they personally want to set the record straight. I think that's their number one motivation.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I don't actually think it's about money. I think it's about revenge is, you know, a value-tinged word, but it's about getting back at people they think have done them wrong.
Susan Page of USA Today, Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, and Bill Crystal of the Weekly Standard. When we come back, it's time to open the phones, take your calls, your email, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., shedding light on current events through the history of espionage. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com. Additional support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Of our three branches of government, the Founding Fathers viewed Congress as the first among equals. But in recent years, the power and influence of the House and Senate has been eclipsed by the president and the courts. What's wrong with Congress and how to fix it? The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to open the phones. First, we'll go to Ada, Michigan. Good morning, Jason. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. First of all, I hope that you'll indulge me for just a moment. And thank
Not
you.
Too long, because okay. We've got lots of callers waiting.
But what I wanted to say was hopefully that people will use all this information and just take into consideration that because over the last 4 years that Republicans have had the majority and the executive, things seem to have gone terribly wrong in this country. And if using the Middle East and the crisis with North Korea, if you can call it that, as examples, people have to go to the polls and vote in order to give this president help, because he needs it badly, and we are not heading in the right direction.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. Of course, voting makes a difference, and this country bears some shame in terms of the percentage of eligible voters who actually get to the polls. How is what's happening now likely to affect November, Susan?
I think it's hard to see this as good news for the people in power, because the situation looks so frightening. The one way in which Republicans will argue, however, I think that they've taken a tougher line against terrorism. They have a clearer policy, but. You know, when people think things are going badly, that's usually bad news for incumbents when elections come around. Americans by 2-1 say the country's headed in the wrong direction. President Bush's approval rating, which is a great thermometer of how people are feeling, got up to 40% in a Gallup poll this week, but generally has had trouble cracking that 40% barrier. That's very low for a president at this point in his
term. All right, let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Sean, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I really am concerned about the proposition that the Bush administration has acted in good faith, and that somehow that covers over the mistakes that are being revealed as a result of their so-called more aggressive policy. I've been reading Ron Suskind's book, The 1% Doctrine, in addition to so many other things that have come out. And I really believe that it is time for those conservatives, neocons, whatever you want to call them, who have pushed forward these policies, this so-called more robust foreign policy that has resulted in so much nonsense, so much mess in the world. I believe it's time for them to not have any more credibility.
Bill Kristol, your credibility is on the line.
It's been shaky for a long time, actually. Ron Suskind's book is about Dick Cheney being excessively concerned about a terrorist attack here, but there haven't been any terrorist attacks here. So let's weigh everything in the balance, and let's, give Bush credit for things and give him blame for things, and let's have a serious comparison of this foreign policy versus the alternatives. Would the world be safer if we hadn't removed the Taliban government in Afghanistan? Would the world be safer if we hadn't dealt with Saddam and he were in power and Zarqawi were living there? He was there, of course, before the war against Iraq, and developing chemical and biological weapons? I don't think so.
Clarence.
Well, I think what's troubling about the Bush approach, and this is not a surprise, when we say acting in good faith, I mean, President Bush said all along from 9/11, he'll do whatever it takes and he'll stop at nothing. And we sent those signals out and made those statements, and we've seen that he wasn't lying. What troubles a lot of people is what I call the adolescent approach to the world, which is testing the limits all the time. And having a 17-year-old at home, I'm constantly dealing with this. But it's the kind of thing that we saw a testing of the limits as far as Guantanamo policy, as far as foreign policy is concerned, as far as national security policy, as far as how much do you have to let Congress in on what you're doing. All these aspects, the administration has tested the limits until they've been pushed back by the Supreme Court or somebody else.
You know, Bill, I think a lot of Democrats would take the question you ask. I mean, there was a great consensus about the invasion of Afghanistan. And toppling the Taliban government in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. But I think a lot of Democrats would argue the world would be in a better shape if we had not invaded Iraq.
Indeed.
And be now dealing with some of the consequences.
All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Hi there, Frank. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, and greetings to everyone. I would like to comment that I think that that history regarding Guantanamo, that history is going to place Guantanamo in the same chapter as Japanese internment and the McCarthy era. And when we look at those two points in our history, we often ask ourselves, how in the world did that possibly happen? And we're seeing today how it happened by the public putting misplaced trust in the values of its leadership. We see it happening because of a cadre of apologists, some of whom have been aired on your show, who would argue that anything Bush and his crowd do, they ought to do. So it's very heartening to see yesterday the JAGs confront this very twisted and un-American approach to these people in Guantanamo and who knows where else in the world, and to see that perhaps the support for Bush and his crowd is finally dissolving, just like McCarthy's support finally dissolved after a number of years.
Clarence.
I don't know if it's support dissolving, but it's more, as I mentioned earlier, imposing limits, okay? You know, saying, hey, you know, we appreciate you're trying to keep America safe, but not at the expense of all of our civil liberties, all of our Bill of Rights, et cetera, et cetera. You know, where do we draw the line? And this is where Congress does have to step up to the plate and do what they're supposed to be doing, which is to debate these issues and say, hey, here's the kind of new rules we ought to have.
I look forward to Congress, and I look forward to members of the media who just dismiss the Bush administration's actions in Guantanamo to coming up with those limits. What are they going to do with these people? I'm really looking forward to the geniuses in Congress
and all the pundits
mm-hmm. and all the citizens out there who think this was such an easy thing to do to explain what they want to do with the 400 people at Guantanamo. They've released, I believe, about 100 people from Guantanamo,
right.
of whom over, I think, 20 or something have been killed or captured again. Engaged in terrorist activities. Some went back to fight with the Taliban in Afghanistan or perhaps in Iraq. I'm really looking forward to finding out that this was such an easy thing to do and that it's obvious. And I'm also looking forward to, the Democrats on the Hill think, incidentally, Bush should stop the eavesdropping program that he launched or the terrorist money tracking program that he launched. Let's see them come up with, are they happy that that's been released to the New York Times? I'm really looking forward to these debates.
Of course, one of the arguments that I think Democrats on the Hill make is not that these programs, these surveillance programs, shouldn't exist, but that they should have some check and balance to them that is outside the administration, either a judicial one or a congressional one or both. And I think the real complaint has not been that the programs have gone forward, but they've gone forward with no one else having a chance to weigh in on them.
Bill has raised a challenge, which I think is important for the country to answer.
Absolutely.
Our current rules were made up during the Cold War, during the 1970s, after all the CIA abuses, after J. Edgar Hoover's abuses. Now I get mail from people saying, well, you haven't seen any abuses yet, have you? Well, that's not the way you play it. You know, no, is that what we want to do? Do we want to wait until abuses happen, or do we want to have a real debate? So I look forward to it, too.
Here's an email from Tom in Granite Falls, North Carolina, who says, if the budget deficit comes up today, I'd like to ask why Bush is bragging about the fourth largest deficit in history. After all, he inherited a $500 billion surplus and has turned that around thanks to his tax cut. Susan.
Well, President Bush came out and bragged about it this week because it went down. They had predicted at the beginning of the year that the deficit would be $423 billion. It's gone down now to $318. Critics say they hyped the original estimate so they could show it going down. On the other hand, it is true that tax revenues have gone up at a rate that hadn't been expected, and this gives President Bush grounds to argue that his tax cut program worked in fueling economic activity.
Let's go to Columbia, Maryland. Good morning, Hosanna. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
I have a question.
Go right ahead.
I'm basically, my question regarding the International Court. One of the problems we have in the Middle East is we decided early on not to engage the current elected government in Palestine. So in order to get this problem resolved without getting back in our tent, we have several international court decisions that basically ruled that occupation of land after the 67 war was illegal, that people cannot be ethnically cleansed, and the Palestinians that were living on the areas where Israel is now established should have the right to return. The Golan Heights occupation completely is illegal. All these things, if done according to law, we don't have a problem in the Middle East.
All right. Bill Kristol.
Well, but the last two attacks were from areas that Israel withdrew from and to internationally recognized borders. So, I mean, Israel got out of South Lebanon. Israel got out of Gaza. This is, if one thinks that as a matter of policy and fairness, it would be good if Israel withdrew from most of the territories they conquered in 1967, this is the worst thing to have happened because they are being attacked from territories they withdrew from.
And here's an interesting email from Larry in Annapolis, Maryland. "'Twould take extraordinary political fortitude, but shouldn't the administration consider asking President Clinton to mediate this mess?" Clarence Page.
Maybe if President Bush talks to his dad, he might get somewhere. I mean, President Clinton has made remarkable personal inroads into the Bush family and elevated himself to a stature close to that of Jimmy Carter as far as international mediator goes. Either one would be great. I don't think it's going
to
happen.
All right. Let's go to Pat, who's in, is it Mays Landing, New Jersey or New York?
New Jersey.
Okay, Pat, you're on the air. Pat.
Yes?
You're on the air. Please go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you very much. I was concerned about the Voting Rights Act. My goodness, I thought that was settled. And I was so surprised to find that Congress, thank God, voted again for it. But I don't understand why it's only got a 25-year life. Why is it not a constitutional amendment? Shouldn't everybody in this country have a right to vote?
Very passionate debate.
Well, they do. They do.
There's
a lot of confusion in the public about this. First of all, number one, yes, the right for everybody to vote, minorities and everybody else, all citizens, is in the Constitution. Voting Rights Act, most of it is permanent. There are three sections of it that need to be renewed so far about every 25 years. And that was what the debate was over this time. And they have to do particularly about enforcing the act in the states, mostly in the Old South, where there's a record of discrimination. And there's also an issue popped up this year about ballots that weren't in English. So the immigration debate spilled over into the voting rights debate. But all of those amendments, I think there were three of them to that effect, that were rejected yesterday.
Although it did become surprisingly a battle. And I think there were not, correct me if I'm wrong, I do not think a majority of Republicans in the House voted to renew these provisions of the Voting Rights Act.
Well, because these are states that were segregationist 40 years ago, that have substantial African-American populations, that have elected African-American office holders, and they're still singled out for special review by the federal government, and that should end at some point. Every state should be treated equally, unless there's proof of discrimination.
They do have the right to opt out, and there's a process for that. And so the states we're seeing now, and they aren't all in the South, are there for reasons.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Susan.
In fact, during the debate, we had, I thought, some very interesting statistics that show how well the Voting Rights Act has worked. In Georgia, a Georgia congressman pointed out that African Americans in Georgia register and vote at a higher rate than whites in Georgia, that there are, I think, three statewide elected African American officials in Georgia now, and that the state legislature, the makeup of the state legislature now reflects the racial makeup of the state.
Let's go to Westlake, Ohio. Good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
2 days after Robert Novak's column appeared in the New York Times identifying Valerie Plame as a covert CIA agent, there was a scathing editorial in our local paper here, The Plain Dealer, and I remember one of the sentences. They quoted George Herbert Walker Bush, the president's father, as saying during a speech at CIA headquarters in 1999 that anyone who discloses the identity of a covert CIA agent is guilty of an act of treason. Now, I realize at that time he was a former president, but he was also a former director of the CIA, so he speaks with a great deal of credibility, I believe.
Any comment, Clarence?
Is the question whether or not it's illegal to expose the identity of a CIA agent?
Indeed.
Well, it is illegal to do so. There's a debate in the Plame case as to whether she was an active agent or not, and technicalities of that nature.
Well, as I said, no one has been prosecuted for any crime here.
That is correct.
An independent special.
That only means lack of evidence. Doesn't mean innocence necessarily.
Just to
be legalistic, Bob. About this.
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, that's my point, that no one has been prosecuted, even though I believe it was a very serious crime, and I believe the president's father does too. My question is, that Kyle, now that Kyle Rove has been identified by Novak as one of the people who disclosed Valerie Plame's identity, wouldn't he be? I realize that the grand jury, Mr. Fitzgerald, said that he wasn't a person of interest anymore. But wouldn't this tweak Mr. Fitzgerald's interest that now that Kyle Rove has been identified as one of the people who did disclose Valerie Plame's identity?
Fitzgerald knew that it was Novak way back at the end of 2000. Well, he knew that Novak had disclosed the identity, and he knew that, I'm sorry, that Karl Rove was one of Novak's sources way back 2 years ago. It's not clear she was covert, and it's not clear anyone knowingly disclosed the identity of a covert CIA operative.
Susan?
Yes, I think it's hard to imagine that Karl Rove now gets revived interest in this special prosecutor case.
But as you said earlier, these things do have a life of their own. You don't know where it's going to go, and you don't know how it's going to unfold, Clarence.
Well, Bill was right as far as not being clear that someone knowingly revealed a CIA agent. The question here is knowingly. For example, Bob Novak's story has actually changed a little bit insofar as whether or not he was told it was Valerie Plame or whether he looked it up later in Who's Who after being told that it was Wilson's wife and that sort of thing. So those are the gray areas that I think caused Fitzgerald to say, oh, well.
But, of course, this lawsuit, whether or not it succeeds, could get people to testify under oath in public ways. And you don't know where that leads. And it also makes this case loom as a continuing distraction to people like Karl Rove, who is, of course, the architect of Republican reelection strategy for 2006.
And for more on this subject, tune in on Monday when Ambassador Joseph Wilson will be on in our first hour. Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard, Susan Page of USA Today, Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Elizabeth Terry. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura RL with super handling all-wheel drive. Information at Acura.com.